from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Foreign home buying in the U.S. way up again in the last year, up from $68 billion to $92 billion in the year ending in March. That's a lot of homes. More than half of these buyers from abroad grabbing properties in just four states: Florida, California, Arizona, and Texas. But they're everywhere, often buying with cash, sometimes laundering that cash. This hour, On Point, foreign buyers in the American real estate market. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you seen global money in your local real estate market? Have you been outbid from abroad? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first from New York City today is Andrew Rice, contributing editor at New York Magazine. His recent big cover story on the foreign home buying land rush in Manhattan is Stash Pad. The New York real estate market is now the premier destination for wealthy foreigners with rubles, yuan, and dollars to hide. Andrew Rice, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
There's all kinds of buying of all kinds of properties across this country. In New York City, there's some of the biggest sort of ultra-rich purchases in the world. But it goes down further than that. You end up saying in here, and there's a lot in here about shady money and money laundering, one of the impacts you're talking about is middle-class buyers driven to despair, in part by big money coming in from abroad into your market, Andrew.
Well, that might have been just partially me speaking from my own experience, frankly.
Yeah, right.
We at New York Magazine, they're very generous, but I'm not able to afford a $1 million all-cash offer quite yet. But I think the thing that when you look at the real estate market in New York, the biggest transformation that's happened since 2008 has been the sort of advent of – it's always been an expensive real estate market. I mean, if you watch Woody Allen movies from the 1970s, they're talking about how expensive the rents
are.
And, of course, the rents are sort of absurdly low by today's standards. But so everyone's always complained about this in New York. But the advent of sort of the all-cash buyer, oftentimes using an entity like an LLC to
limited liability corporation, yeah.
Yes, a limited liability corporation to purchase this property is relatively new. This is something – this is a symbolic of a flood of investor money coming into the marketplace, which is a little different than actual local home buyers competing, which – you know, there's always been that competition among local home buyers. But the investment thing is new.
And who's coming in? I mean, on the Statue of Liberty, of course, it says, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. Is that who's coming to buy up New York?
Well, definitely not tired, poor, possibly huddled. You know, like even $1 million doesn't buy you quite as much space in New York as you might think.
Might still be huddled.
That said, I mean, I think, you know, it's very difficult to say exactly where the money is coming from. But one sort of anecdotal piece of evidence is that the marketing firm Cork & Sunshine, which markets new luxury properties in New York, says that about half of its says about 35% of its buyers have been foreign in the last year. About half of them are from Asia. Most of those Asian buyers are from China, and the rest of the other 50% of the foreign buyers are split relatively evenly between Europe, Latin America, and the rest of the world.
And I'm looking here at a list of the top 10 countries of origin for buyers nationwide. You got Germany, Sweden, Canada, Australia, the UK, and then Italy, France, Hong Kong, China, Switzerland, and number one, United Arab Emirates in terms of growth of these properties. Look at China. Lots of Chinese buying. They're number one or number two in the market. Chinese buyers in New York, in Maine, Indiana, Missouri, Colorado, Wyoming, and Hawaii, you remind us. You open your piece with an Italian buyer looking at something just over $1 million in New York, which in New York City is not at all over the moon. So you've got people who are ultra rich, but what's somebody who wants to buy a $1 million apartment doing in New York? Why was she there?
Well, first of all, there are some stratifications here. I mean, you have the ultra rich who are the people who are buying at buildings like 157 on 57th Street, which is probably the most high profile of these buildings, where, you know, the penthouse is reportedly in contract for $90 million. But then it goes all the way down to at the quote unquote sort of affordable price range of Manhattan, which is, as you say, is sort of around the median price is around $1.3 million for a Manhattan condo these days. Mm-hmm. This buyer happened to be that I spent some time with. I mean, she happened to be a wealthy person. I mean, anyone who's got $1.3 million sitting around to invest in an investment property is not a poor person.
Yeah.
But she had, you know, but also not sort of private jet rich. And she was looking for a place to invest some money. And New York real estate was a stable, safe, but most of all discreet place to put her money.
And lots of people feel the same. There's an amazing number in your story. The Census Bureau estimating that 30% of all apartments in this area from 49th Street to 70th Street between 5th and Park are vacant at least 10 months a year. Those are people who are not living there. I don't know. Maybe they're regular houses in Phoenix or in Cleveland. But a lot of those, foreign owners.
Yeah, I mean, now we're getting that area. You know, for your listeners who maybe don't know New York, that area is sort of the Fifth Avenue, Park Avenue, the sort of premier, most expensive area of New York traditionally, and so the Census Bureau's number is quite striking. I mean, we have this sort of anecdotal feeling that when you drive by these buildings, all the lights are out at night, and you wonder who owns those places. And in many cases, it's quite wealthy foreign people. Now they're not taking the strategy that the Italian that I was going mm-hmm. around with was taking, where she was renting the property out and basically capturing that rental income. They're actually just sort of putting their money in using the property, you know, as a pied-à-terre, also a little bit like a safe deposit box. You know, it's not going to – New York real estate, though, you know, it continues to increase. It's not necessarily going to get you the, you know, a 30% return like the S&P, but, you know, in the course of a year. But it's probably not going to go down too much. So the idea is that if you have, if you have $50 million to spend, as a Brazilian real estate broker who often deals with high net worth people from Brazil and Switzerland told me, you know, that they go in to these meetings in Geneva or Sao Paulo, and the pitch is, you know, if you have $100 million to invest someplace, here is a place where you can put it where it'll be safe, it'll be secure. And again, if you do it the right way, if you structure it via these corporate entities, it won't necessarily be detectable to your home country's tax officials.
Which turns out to be a big deal in many of these cases. And when you talk about $100 million, in some cases in Manhattan today, that's one condo.
Right. Well, I mean, you can spend your $100 million in a lot of different ways. I mean, you have people who are buying, you know, ultra-high-end penthouse-type purchases. And then you have, brokers say that there is a species of new investor coming into the marketplace who are buying up multiple properties for their $100 million. You know, maybe 5 or 6 $20 or $15 or $20 million properties. And those can actually be – believe it or not, there's actually a rental market for penthouses where, you know, sort of high-end properties that are, you know, might cost $15 or $20 million. You can rent those out for $100,000 a month.
Foreign buyers, Andrew Rice writes, have become an overpowering force in New York's real estate market. Since 2008, roughly 30% of condo sales in large-scale Manhattan developments have been to purchasers who either listed an overseas address or bought through an entity like a limited liability corporation, a tactic rarely employed by local homebuyers. Many of these cash. And then we get to the shadowy part. We're going to look on across the country. But the shadowy part, and not only in New York, but certainly in New York, plenty of indications of not just tax avoidance abroad, let's say, but money laundering, some pretty crazy cash coming into your town, Andrew.
Well, I mean, you know, there are estimates that the amount of money laundered worldwide every year is on the order of about $1.5 trillion. And it's well known to money laundering experts that that property is one of the preferred places for criminal proceeds to end up, because it can be discreet, it's relatively safe investment, and you know the money launderers have status aspirations too. So oftentimes you will find that the people who have profited off of criminal enterprises will invest some of that money in a very fancy place to live. You know, it's hard to estimate how much of an impact this particular aspect makes on the New York real estate market. But we do know from multiple Senate investigations conducted by Carl Levin, a Democrat of Michigan, that he's done quite a bit of research into the use of New York property of American property as a method for laundering the proceeds of foreign corruption. So, for instance, the son of the dictator of Equatorial Guinea had a $30 million Malibu mansion. Yeah. There was a case in New York, a very high profile case of the former prime minister of Taiwan, who part of his $6 million cash bribe ended up being invested in a condo here in Chelsea. So it is ending up here. It's a little hard to measure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about foreign buyers in the American real estate market buying houses, condos, penthouses, palaces, and the all-cash gusher from abroad that is sometimes pretty shady. Andrew Rice is with us from New York Magazine. He's looked a lot at what's going on in Manhattan. His big cover piece is Stash Pad, how the New York real estate market is now the premier destination for wealthy foreigners with rubles, yuan, and dollars to hide. It's quite a story. We'll hear more about how all that works. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Lots of response online already here. Andrew Yar writes, in times of turmoil, put your resources into something real. We're experiencing a cash bubble. The dam will break. I don't know if those real estate prices will hold up or not. Sue writes to us, if I paid what Europeans paid for health care and child care, I could afford a home in another country too. Okay. Nonlinear Time writes to us, my husband and I were looking to buy a house in Austin, Texas. And we encountered a very nice bungalow in a very hot neighborhood that had been completely renovated. While walking through, the real estate agent mentioned it was owned by an African investor who also owned another house down the street, was almost finished renovating and selling another the previous month. Based on what I know about real estate in that neighborhood, that investor is probably making a 50% profit on the original purchase price. It's not all gazillionaires. Here's just an investor from Africa who's doing what Americans have often done, looking to make a gain in the American real estate market, Andrew.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should be careful to make the caveat that foreign investment in real estate is economically it has many positive effects for New York City nationally. I mean, I believe it. The foreign direct investment in real estate, something like $50 billion a year in the United States. I mean, that's not a negligible amount of money. And in New York, which is the area in which I have the most expertise, foreign investors were largely responsible for helping a lot of the condo projects that were in deep trouble, after 2008. That those developers, I mean, some of them went bust anyway, but the buyers, to the extent that those buildings found buyers, they were often cash buyers coming in from foreign countries taking great bargains, actually, that could be found in 2008 and 2009 at a time when most American buyers couldn't get a mortgage, were petrified of the perceived risk of the marketplace. This is true also in Miami. I mean, Miami, I know, is even more more of an all-cash buying economy than New York. A lot of that's being driven by investors from Brazil, Argentina, Venezuela, coming and basically buying real estate in Miami because, first of all, there was a lot of it after 2008,
yep.
A lot of empty buildings. And second of all, because they have currency turmoil at home and economic turmoil at home. Brazil to a lesser extent than Argentina and Venezuela, but still.
The U.S. seen as a kind of safety deposit box, a little safer than that home. Let me get a call right here from Bill in Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Bill. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. Hi. Great show.
Thank you.
I'm in Newton, Massachusetts, but I split my time in Vancouver, British Columbia. And today, you guys are talking about a newly released movie. And for me, I'm listening to the sequel because this same phenomenon has been going on in Vancouver for at least a decade.
What's the evidence? What do you see? What have you seen, Bill?
Well, there have been some studies. I wish I could quote the numbers to you, but there's in a lot of real estate markets, there's a ratio of median income to median housing prices, and Vancouver is off the charts. Many people who, this is anecdotal, but many people who grow up in Vancouver find it impossible to afford the housing. The median single-family home price in Vancouver is over $1 million Canadian, which would be about $950,000 U.S.
And what's driving it out of whack, Bill? Why is housing so much more expensive than Vancouver residents can afford?
It's foreign buyers that are skewing the market. And what we see it in something that's known locally as zombie towers. These are 15, 20-story condominium towers, brand-new construction. The units are sold before the building even breaks ground, and no one lives there, or almost no one lives there. And that's why they're called zombie towers.
Oh, boy, that's kind of depressing. On the other hand, Bill, here you are, an American who's, I don't know, do you own property in Canada? Are you also one of these devil foreign buyers yourself?
No, there are other issues in Canada with Americans, but driving up the real estate prices is generally not one of them. This is generally perceived as Asian money. Some of and the expression is that Vancouver has become a hedge city. And there's been studies actually that show when things get a little tense or bad in China, the price of Vancouver real estate goes up. So Asian people are parking money there. It's a hedge, and some of it is suspected also to be laundered money, largely from Pakistan.
People buying all over the place. Bill, I really appreciate your call. Of course, I was reading here in the New York Post just a couple of months ago a piece from a Canadian who had bought in the United States, Andrew. And, of course, Canadians are among the biggest buyers here. I guess if I lived up in that icy burg, I'd want something south and warmer, too. This was Diane Francis out of Toronto. They said we just bought a condo on 57th Street. And they felt demonized in the New York press. Populist resentment. You talked about people buying pita tares. They said we've been cast as pita terrorists. She writes, as we say in Canada, give me a break. Robust condo sales to people like us have brought economic development and jobs. Andrew Rice, stand by in New York. I want to go to Jed Kolko in San Francisco, chief economist at the real estate website Trulia, leads their research on real estate market trends. Jed Kolko in San Francisco, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
We're well. So what do you track at Trulia? Do you track who buys what or who's looking for what?
At Trulia, we can see who is looking for homes across the U.S. We're able to see the types of homes they're looking at, the neighborhoods they're searching in, and the country they're searching from. One of the things that stands out is how geographically concentrated a lot of the foreign interest is. So far on the show, we've been talking about what's going on in New York, but New York is, of course, not all Fifth Avenue. Most of New York is boroughs other than Manhattan, but the foreign search activity is very concentrated in neighborhoods like Midtown and Lower Manhattan, as well as the oceanfront parts of Miami and the west side of Los Angeles.
What else makes your list there? I don't know, San Francisco, Hawaii?
It really varies depending on the country that we're talking about. So Canadians do a huge amount of searching for homes in the Phoenix area, parts of Florida, and vacation homes in the Palm Springs area east of L.A.
They want to get warm in the winter. That's understandable. Okay.
Exactly. We also see a lot of Europeans searching in Florida, and there are particular parts of Florida that end up being very popular with people from particular countries. There's a lot of searching from the U.K. in the Orlando area, whereas Germans tend to search in the southwest part of Florida around Naples, and Cape Coral.
What about the price range that different countries' nationals hunt in?
Canadians tend to look at more modest homes in the U.S. Partly that's because the markets that they're looking in tend to be more modestly priced markets, like Arizona and Florida.
So you're looking at, I'm reading here, maybe $250,000 is the asking price they're looking for.
That's right. The median price of homes that Canadians are looking at in the U.S. is about $250,000.
Okay.
Chinese, it's about $400,000. But remember, a lot of the Chinese interest is on the West Coast, and those are markets that are more expensive to begin with. It doesn't necessarily mean that the Chinese are only looking at mansions. It means that they're looking in more expensive markets like Los Angeles and the Bay Area.
How do you see the net effects of all this foreign interest in American real estate, Jed?
I think there are several effects. I mean, the first one, of course, is the impact on home prices. In places where there's a lot of foreign interest, home prices can get detached from local incomes, because part of the demand for real estate depends on foreign incomes, not just local incomes. But remember, of course, higher home prices are bad for locals who are looking to buy, but they're good for sellers. So people in the U.S. who are looking to sell their home might appreciate the fact that foreign demand is boosting home prices.
And what about the longer-term effect on supply?
Well, right now, there's a lot of foreign interest in many markets where inventory is tight to begin with, particularly in parts of California. The longer-term effect on supply depends a lot on whether foreigners are actually moving to the U.S. And occupying those homes, or whether they're staying vacant, or whether they're investing in them to rent them out. Remember, there was a period over the past couple of years when a lot of domestic investors were buying up empty single-family homes, many of them that had been foreclosed, and rented them out, adding to the rental supply. Foreign investors, of course, are looking at a somewhat different market. Many of them are using them as vacation homes, occupying them only as part of the year. But if there is more foreign demand, that could actually boost construction in some areas because the housing stock in the U.S. needs to keep up with local demand as well.
How do you read why all this is happening now? I mean, here we're looking between 2009 and 2013. Demand from, let's say, the United Arab Emirates, the UAE, up 352%, the most of any country. Why in this period? And is this a blip? Is there something, is this just trying to buy in after the property crash in the U.S. and get a good deal? Or is this a sense that the world is becoming smaller, so why not? Or the world's becoming less stable, so maybe the U.S. is a steady place to be?
Part of this is definitely about U.S. homes, U.S. real estate, having looked undervalued in recent years. After the bubble burst, homes looked undervalued compared to long-term fundamentals. U.S. homes looked like a bargain, especially compared to other parts of the world. And for instance, when we talk about Chinese investment, the conversation earlier about there having been lots of investment in Vancouver and other parts of Canada. Right now, though, Canadian homes look overvalued. There's a lot of bubble concern in Canada, while U.S. homes still look relatively affordable. So a lot of it has to do with the U.S. market. It also has to do with what's happening with both stability and wealth in other countries. And the other part, of course, is with sites like Trulia and other places, it's easier for people to look for homes in another part of the country or in another part of the world.
Yeah. Go shopping from Shanghai, it's no problem. Dave is calling from Berlin, Connecticut. Dave, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Interesting show today.
Great. What do you think?
We've done this before. Back in the 80s, there was all this you can read old New York Times articles, brouhaha about when the Japanese economy was booming and they were coming to New York and San Francisco.
And Hawaii, yes.
Yeah, and there were big, there was actually a science fiction story about New York had been flooded by global warming and they were coming over to buy the Statue of Liberty and the Empire State Building. I mean, this is nothing to worry about. It's kind of what the free market system produces, and you know, things go up right now. It's up in China, so they have money to buy things.
Hey, easy for you to say, Dave, but what if you're in the market in one of these towns where prices are being driven up to a new tier by money and incomes you can't match?
Well, that's a difficult decision, but there are a lot of places where you can go where the real estate isn't like that. I mean, I'm in Connecticut. The real estate here in Connecticut is actually pretty much a bargain as a result of the local economy.
Yeah.
And now with people you know, with people being basically, you can work and do almost anything anywhere. I mean, you know, you don't have to be right in an office somewhere to do your job.
Dave, point taken. Andrew, how about it? Hey, if you can't afford it, Andrew, live in Poughkeepsie. You can do your job there.
I mean, it's that's the way the free market system works, and you know, it's certainly an argument. I personally think that there. My story isn't. I didn't set out with an agenda to stop people from buying real estate or coming from abroad. I was interested in describing a phenomenon that has been quite opaque to most New Yorkers. Oftentimes, you know, one of the things the previous caller just brought up was that this precedent of the Japanese in the 1980s, and that came up in a lot of my conversations. I think one of the things that's a little different is that there is such a – this is a much broader-based kind of wave of investment. It's not just – the Japanese coming to buy the Empire State Building. I think they might have actually literally bought the Empire State Building. I can't remember the exact circumstances. Maybe it was Rockefeller Center, but you know, these big landmark kind of trophy buildings or sort of extremely high profile trophy type purchases. I mean, this is a kind of a more broad based sort of phenomenon. And as we said, as you quoted at the top of the show, I mean, 30% of all condos and large scale new Manhattan development are going to either buyers who list a foreign address or to companies that we don't actually really know who's behind those companies. And I do think it's New Yorkers have an interest in knowing who their neighbors are. I don't think that there's anything anything wrong with saying we should have an idea of like why our rental market buying market is behaving in the way it does.
Jim in Lyneborough, New Hampshire. Jim, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks. Just some quick questions. Maybe your experts can answer. What are the details around citizenship for the United States and owning private property in it? Meaning, if you're not allowed to reside in the U.S. or enter the U.S., are you still allowed to own private property, even though you may not be able to occupy it? And then, if you are allowed to own it, what happens if something goes wrong on your property, meaning a pipe bursts? I'm the neighbor of one of these zombie properties. How do I sue somebody that's not a citizen of the United States because their property damaged my property? Like, these are things that we don't have problems with U.S. citizens, but with non-citizens, what are the rules around this?
Yeah, Jim, we're right into it right there. Andrew, first of all, on a visa, if you spend enough, a visa kind of comes with it. Is that right?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, there are certain programs under a federal program called the EB-5 visa program, where if you invest a certain amount of money in
how much?
It's actually I am blanking. I believe it's $100,000, but don't quote. But
I just quoted myself on that. Okay.
but if you spend a certain amount of money, you can qualify for a green card via the EB-5 program. And actually, some developers in New York have set up funds to basically capture this money. You have to demonstrate that you're creating jobs. But one of the ways that you can create jobs via foreign investment is construction jobs. If you're getting into construction financing. You know, these are oftentimes investments that are being made with a very low rate of return, but like the return that the foreign investor gets back is a visa, which is obviously a great inducement to be able to show a potential investor.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about foreign buyers in the American real estate market, buying houses, condos, penthouses, palaces. Andrew Rias writes about it in his New York Magazine cover story, Stash Pad. The New York real estate market is now the premier destination for wealthy foreigners with rubles, yuan, and dollars to hide, is his headline there. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. It's right across the country as well in many different ways. Chief economist at the real estate website Trulia, Jed Kolko, joins us from San Francisco. Let's get a call right here from Waltham, Massachusetts, and James. James, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I was came into the story a little later, but I couldn't help but think about some previous news stories I'd heard about a rise in the American home building business, as well as the real estate business. And I couldn't help but draw, you know, some sort of idea that maybe foreign investment was skewing those numbers. So I was wondering if foreign investments were actually altering and possibly ruining economists' predictions of how well the American consumer and the American home buyer is actually doing.
Interesting. We'll put it to our economist. Thanks, James. Jed Kolko, what about it? Does it throw off our housing stock, housing starts, housing numbers in general?
In some markets where foreign buyers have been particularly active, that could be giving a boost to construction activity. But the bigger reason why there's been a boom in apartment construction over the past year or so has to do with domestic issues. It has to do with young people who had been living in their parents' homes during the recession now starting to move out and creating a generation of new renters. And builders are responding to that demand. So the construction boom that we've seen in many cities has more to do with young people in the U.S. rather than with foreign demand.
Yeah, they're in there. Another caller here from Oriskany, New York. Jed, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
You know, I don't have any sympathy for these New York City people that are complaining about foreign residents coming in and buying up property, because, you know, in northern New York here, the New York City people have been coming up here for years and doing it to us.
Right.
You know,
turnabout's fair play.
What's that?
Turnabout's fair play. Their turn to taste the big buyer.
They're getting a dose of their own medicine, you know? We've been driven off our land for years, priced out of the market.
Yeah.
The rich New Yorkers come up to northern New York and buy up the, you know, the land around lakes and nice old farms and things like that, and drive off the people that used to own them. We can't afford to own property.
Jed, we got it. We've got it loud and clear. I hear it. I mean, it is indeed an old story in many ways. Andrew Rice, you bum out of New York City.
I'm sure there were Indians who were complaining about the fact that Peter Minuit's, you know, $24 in beads for Manhattan was just an outrageous.
I mean, but it has happened. Some version of this has happened many times to many people. Sometimes from abroad, sometimes not. One thing that struck me in your piece, Andrew, is how you're talking about global. Globalization. We all know about the big inequities of wealth that have grown and grown, and New York, among a few other cities around the globe, becoming one of these real lockboxes for super wealth. That's part of what you're really focusing on here.
Yeah, I mean, every year there's something called the Wealth Report that's put up by an international real estate brokerage called Knight Frank, and they came up with this like oddly precise estimate that there's, I think it was 167,669 people in the world who are ultra high net worth, mm-hmm. which meant that they had assets in excess of $30 million. That number is going up. The biggest growth is happening, percentage-wise, the biggest growth is happening in Asia and in Africa. So it's creating, as the rich get richer and as the divide between the super wealthy and the rest of everybody else gets wider and wider, there are economic effects that you see. I mean, you see it in New York in a whole kind of crop of ultra luxury apartment buildings that are going up around Central Park, and you say, well, what's wrong with that? Like, you know, why should normal New Yorkers care about that? Well, one of the reasons that people have been complaining is that all these very super tall towers are literally casting shadows over Central Park. So, in a way, taking away a public good that's existed for a century or more of the sun in Central Park.
So there's that. And then David writes to us, says, what are the property taxes being paid by foreign property owners? You know, it'll be raising hundreds of million dollars for the city of New York. But you're talking here about at least one condo where they're giving tax breaks, very, very high end, 94% tax breaks. The New York Times analysis estimated that the priciest penthouse, this is at 157, reportedly on contract under contract for $90 million, and they'd be paying less than $1,500 a month in taxes. Is that possible?
Yes, it's very much possible. It's under a city program, and this is one of the peculiarities of New York. And as Jed has been stressing, I think we should say that New York's marketplace is its own animal. But New York has tax abatement programs for new construction, essentially to promote construction, create construction jobs, make things easier for developers. And buyers in new construction are able to take advantage of these tax breaks. They're phased out over a 10-year period. But if you're a foreign investor looking to purchase and flip the property on like a 5-year time horizon,
yep,
then the tax abatement works great for you.
Let's go to Carol in Austin, Texas. Carol, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Ah, thank you. I was wanted to make a comment about foreign investors here in Austin, Texas. Some of our investors will purchase 5 homes at a time in a new subdivision, which makes it really hard for traditional buyers to purchase homes. If they come in with their cash, they knock out any other traditional home buyers. So it makes it really hard here in Austin.
And snapping up 5 homes at a time with cash. Wow, there's a report from the front line. Jed, can you explain why cash is tied to foreign real estate purchases so often?
There are a couple of reasons why we've seen an increase in all cash purchases. Some of it is foreign buyers who are coming in with enough money that they can afford to pay all cash. But remember that we've also seen an increase in all cash purchases over the past couple of years domestically, especially with investors who are buying up foreclosed homes. The discussion we've had about foreign buyers is only one part of the bigger story in the U.S. real estate market about investor buying and all-cash purchases. Another reason, of course, why we're seeing more all-cash purchases now is that mortgage rates spiked starting last summer. So some people who might have not needed a mortgage chose to get one when rates were so low, but are now choosing to pay all cash.
And, of course, another reason that Andrew pays a lot of attention to in his piece is that there's no small business in money laundering that goes with this. You quote a realtor in New York saying, "Real estate is a wonderful way to cleanse money. Once you buy real estate, the derivation of that cash is forgotten."
A lawyer, actually.
And you look plenty at the shady side of this. People setting up shell companies in the U.S. to buy through. You're right. It's easier to set up an untraceable shell company in the U.S. than in any country in the world other than Kenya. According to a study here that found that firms in business-friendly states like Delaware and Nevada were particularly abysmal about tracking down where the money came from, the origin. Shima Baradaran is with us right now from the University of Utah, law professor there, joining us today from San Clemente, California. Shima's led a group that looked at exactly this. Shima, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
So here's a listener saying, how are they bringing the money in? Is it bank transfers? Is it Liechtenstein, Cayman Islands, Hong Kong? You know, how's this work? How is it working, Shima, when it's shady money?
Sure. I mean, really, once you set up a shell company, it's very easy. And Andrew's article actually did a great job of demonstrating how that happens. So you have cash from a bribe, money laundering, some other illegal activity. If you're able to put that into real estate, that basically cleanses it, and then you can kind of do what you want with it. So that's one way, you know, according to Andrew's article. But we actually showed in our study that the U.S. is probably the easiest place to form a shell company of all the countries in the world. We did a study of 181 countries and reached out to about 3,700 of these types of companies. They're called incorporation service providers, but they basically form shell companies all over the world. And it was disheartening to myself and the three political scientists I work with, Jason Charman and Dan Nielsen and Michael Finley, that it was so easy within the U.S. to form these, especially in the very business-friendly states like Delaware, Nevada, Wyoming.
Andrew writes, the laundering process typically happens in stages. Illegal cash enters the world financial system somewhere, funneled into a maze of accounts, shell companies, a process called layering. Finally, at the other end, funds are integrated into a seemingly respectable investment, like a luxury condo. He quotes you, Shima, saying, we purposely made it as shady as possible.
Our study. So, yeah, it's what we did was actually, it was kind of like a field experiment where we posed as investors. So what we did was we emailed all of these incorporation service providers just to see how easy it was to form a shell company abroad. And we pretended to be a various number of people. So in one of the treatments, we were, you know, someone from Europe with a name like John Smith from Norway, you know, trying not to raise any kind of shadiness bells. And then we had other treatments, you know, the most kind of shady according to a lot of the due diligence standards abroad and the Financial Action Task Force was one where we pretended we were consulting for an Islamic charity in Saudi Arabia, and we were from one of four of the most terrorist harboring countries in the world. And we said, basically, this is my name, this is where I'm from, I want to form a shell company. And, you know, I don't want to tell you what it's for, I just want to form this. And basically, we're able to form this in every country in the world and in all the states in the world. And I think about one in seven of all of the attempts that we made were successful for that. So,
but some of the easiest in the world right here in the USA, in Delaware.
Exactly.
I mean, Andrew Rice, Delaware. The bottom line that you take from it is American institutions don't care.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think Shima's the world expert on this, or her team definitely. But you know, my just in my anecdotal conversations with many attorneys who work in this real estate market here in New York, you know, they also provide this service of setting up LLCs, and their general attitude I would characterize as sort of like don't ask, don't tell.
Boy, Ken in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Ken, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you think of all this, Ken?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Good show. Love you. Love your show.
Great.
I'm an office industrial real estate broker, investor, and property manager. And what's going on, the dynamic in South Florida is like Groundhog Day. You know, it's happening all over again. You drive down to South, you know, Florida, in Miami specifically, along the beach and on the downtown market, there are cranes everywhere. Most of the deals are all cash deals. In my personal neighborhood, which is a country club, on the west part of the county, in Broward County, which is Fort Lauderdale, all the buyers of my neighbors' houses who are moving for one reason or another are from Venezuela, Colombia, or Brazil, and they're all cash deals. I'm talking $500,000, $700,000, $800,000 deals, all cash.
So you're sort of in the business, Ken, so that must be good for you, I guess. But is this a good thing? How do you look at it?
No, I really don't think it's good, because I think there's a new bubble forming, and what concerns me is that a lot of this money, like your panelist from New York, it's capital flight dollars, and the reasons for investing in some of the real estate, whether it's office or industrial or residential, is really to stash money away, and those investors don't care so much what their rate of return is. And that affects the market negatively, where an onshore investor cannot compete. So if you had an investment requirement of making 3 or 4, you know, most people want 8 to 10% returns. The foreign buyers, Tom, they don't care. They don't care if they make 3%, as long as their money is parked and considered a safe investment onshore. And that, in my opinion, creates bubble kind of environment on both residential and commercial. It's not sustainable.
The U.S. property market is a giant funnel bringing in this cash, and where does it go? Jed, what about it? You're our economist here. Does it build a bubble? It sounds like in Ken's neighborhood, you know, it you can't find economic sense in it. You can find geopolitical sense or security sense.
The U.S. housing market still looks very far from bubble territory. Nationally, prices look about 3% undervalued compared to where they should be relative to fundamentals. There are some markets in the U.S. That do look more overvalued, particularly in Southern California, but there are many markets where there's a lot of foreign interest that do not overall look overvalued. So I am not worried right now about a U.S. bubble forming, even though Southern California is starting to look a little bit bubbly.
You got to check out Ken's neighborhood there sometime. Shima, where do you see this taking us overall? Is this a good thing? Is this a strange agglomeration of wealth that real estate is now the vessel for, and that wealth not necessarily, you know, nicely put together?
Sure. I mean, as a criminal law professor, I think my natural tendency is to worry. I'm a little worried about how easy it is. So we have really tight regulations on banking in the United States. We really don't have very tight regulations on the formation of shell companies. And my worry is that a lot of the cash that's coming into the U.S. is coming from really shady sources, supporting a lot of criminal activities abroad. And that's my kind of biggest worry as a criminal law professor, that's what's happening with this money. And we have no way to trace it unless there are more regulations. And the, you know, Carl Levin was proposing some legislation earlier this year. It didn't really get anywhere. And actually now the IRS is starting to try to get involved to try to find out more and get a little bit more disclosure when these shell companies are formed. So, you know, that's kind of the way I would like this to go, so that if there is foreign real estate in the market, if people are buying these homes up, that we at least know where the money is coming from, that we're not, you know, unknowingly allowing criminal, you know, masterminds in other countries to buy up our real estate and move into our neighborhoods. I think that's my larger concern.
Yep. Shima Bharadaran, University of Utah, law professor there. Thanks very much for joining us, Shima.
Thank you.
And Jed Kolka, we're just about out of time, but thank you so much for joining us, chief economist at Trulia, the real estate website.
Thanks very much.
Andrew, is this where we end up? These Canadians buying their little condos are evil oligarchs and drug runners? I mean, is that what you're warning us about here, or do we have a problem?
I don't think we have a problem. I would just like to say, I mean, to echo what Shima said, I think the most important thing is to have more disclosure. Why is it possible to set up an LLC without any disclosure to the federal government, even to the IRS, about who the beneficial owner of that LLC is? I think this is like yet another case in which the cure for the problem is more sunlight.
Well. We've got a globalized world and all kinds of wrinkles in it. You show us this one in a big way in your piece in New York Magazine. Andrew Rice, always great to have you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Listeners, good luck. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.